Hey everyone! The Uncharted Veterinary Conference is just around the corner, and I have to take a quick second to say thank you to our amazing industry partners, because without them, the Uncharted Veterinary Conference wouldn't be possible. So from the bottom of our Uncharted hearts, I just want to say thank you to this year's partners, Nationwide, Nutramax, Hill's Pet Nutrition, Care Credit, and InTouch Practice Communications. This group is absolutely amazing. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the whole crew. Hey, everybody. I am Stephanie Goss, and this is another episode of the Uncharted Podcast. This week on the podcast, I get to have one of my closest friends, Dr. Phil Richmond, with me to handle a pretty serious question. And I want to say right up front, we're going to be discussing suicide. So we've got some heavy subject matter today. So if this is something that is triggering to you, you may want to skip through this week's episode or read the transcripts. And I think my favorite part about this episode was that Phil and I really got to talk about something that we're both super passionate about, which is breaking the silence around topics that generally feel uncomfortable or taboo to talk about, and really addressing some of the stigma and shame that comes with mental health, talking about mental health in veterinary medicine, that comes from talking about suicide and the risk factors in our line of work, and really any high stress line of work. And so I think that was my favorite part, but we really talked about a whole bunch. This is one of my favorite episodes. So let's get into it.
And now, the Uncharted Podcast.
And we're back. It's me, Stephanie Goss, and today I am joined by a very special, very, very special co-host and guest. My dear friend, Dr. Phil Richmond, is back by popular demand. I feel like everybody is like, oh my God, I love when you and Phil podcast together. I feel like Andy better watch out, because, you know, you might be in the running to take over his sidekick gig with me, Phil. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. And I still think this holds true that I am the Wish app Andy Rourke. Or Timu, maybe. Oh, is that new? They did have a hell of a presence though. But yeah, the Wish app Andy Rourke. But yeah, so we've got something in the mailbag that you mentioned. That
first of all, I want to start by giving a footnote up front that we did get a mailbag, a letter that has to do with mental health, that has to do with talking about suicide in the team, and we're going to talk about some hard topics today. And so if this is something that is triggering for you, this may be an episode that you want to skim through the transcript or skip altogether. So I wanted to say that up front. And when I got, you're not wrong, Phil, when I got this mailbag email, the first person I thought of was you, because although I think Andy and I are more than capable of having conversation about this, I think that your unique life experiences and the work that you do within veterinary medicine give you a unique perspective that I wanted to bring into this. So first of all, knowing that we're going to talk about some hard topics today. Second of all, knowing that we're going to drop some resources into the show notes. So if you don't normally check out the show notes for this one, we're going to have some HR resources, some scientific data study info as well. So make sure to check out the show notes for this episode. But we did get a mailbag. So we got a mailbag letter from a practice manager who manages a hospital that has team members in the hospital overnight. And they sent an email because they had their own personal first, which is, and I'm going to use their words here, they had a team member who attempted suicide due to personal struggles at home. And so they had some multifaceted questions that they wanted help with. And they are struggling with, you know, they have done, I think, a wonderful job of supporting this team member. They said, you know, we have given them time off paid. We are supporting them with access to mental health resources and care, which I think is wonderful. And usually sometimes the first step where we as managers panic, right, is knowing, what do I do when something like this happens? But their questions are, okay, this has already happened. They've gone out on leave. They're being supported. And there is a return to work plan and a timeline for when they're at this point planning to come back to work. And they had a lot of questions about what happens when this team member comes back. How do I support them in the practice from a mental health perspective and standpoint? What steps do we as a practice take to support this team member and also protect the hospital, but protect them within the hospital, because this is a credentialed team member who has access to the controlled drug cabinet and just drugs in general. And the unique circumstances are that while this team member is often buddied with someone else, there are absolutely times where this team member is working as the solo paraprofessional staff in the ER or ICU or overnights. And so they said, you know, I have concerns about what the risk factors might be here, and I want to support them, and I want to know how do I do this. And they're struggling because they feel like the clinic has always been a very safe place for them, and they want it to be a safe place for this team member. And they're concerned about, are we doing them harm by letting them continue to have access to medications? And from the manager's perspective, feeling like they may be increasing the risk if they don't do some things. And so I just thought, what a great set of questions. And the way that they asked them was wonderful. And I thought of you, Phil, and I thought this would be a good one for us to talk through together.
Yeah, absolutely. And just so, you know, I think one of the things that comes through when, you know, we hear what this person's concern was, is that there's, you know, there's a couple of things. And one is that there's a genuine desire to support, you know, this person. You know, and I think that certainly is something across the board that we see, you know, in veterinary hospitals. You know, when it's a relatively small group, we all know each other very well, and it's just, we want what's best. And some of these things, also remembering that we are veterinary professionals, but what we aren't is we're not mental health professionals. So we don't have to, we don't have to have the answers for everything, you know, as far as, you know, healing this person or anything like that. But we can do the things that are evidence-based that you know, moving forward are going to be best to, you know, to help protect that person reintegrating.
Yeah.
So we'll start. So this person is now on FMLA.
They're on leave.
Yeah.
And then they're going to come back to the practice. And so let's start with Headspace. I don't have a whole lot here. I just have a couple of things. I think when you and I talked about this, we both got really excited about digging into to the action steps. And I think from a Headspace perspective, recognizing that this is emotional. Like, this is an emotional topic. Mm-hmm. It's emotionally charged for all the reasons you just mentioned. You have a team that cares about each other. We work in a compassion focused environment. And when you care about someone, no matter what happens and how well you try and prepare for it, is going to be emotional. And so I think owning that as a leader is really important, and taking the time to process your own emotions and recognizing that it might not just be this team member that needs support from a mental health or emotional perspective right now, that when something like this happens within a team environment, it's really important, yes, to focus on this person and how we can support them, and take a step back as the leader and let yourself be supported and support the rest of your team as well, because it is going to be emotional.
Yeah. And I think what we can do, you know, and what I'd also say, you know, we said this is going to be emotional. And I think a couple of the emotions too that we have to just be aware of as leaders is, one is fear, you know, because then there's a fear of, you know, and bias, you know, and we talked about this a little bit. Yes. And so what are guiding, you know, when I have a fear around having the person have access to the, you know, that they potentially have access to the, you know, to the box is
drug box.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is asking, is it warranted? And I'm not saying it's not. However, there are some things that we want to know about. And so a couple of things that I want to say is, you know, when we talk about someone who's in a position that, you know, has tried to take their own life, is that it's, it, it's always, suicide is always multifactorial, meaning that there's not one single, you know, event that's going to cause it. There are, oftentimes there are a number of other things. And one of the things mm-hmm. we know is one of the bigger risk factors is just undiagnosed mental illness, is that, you know, and so mm-hmm. if this person is out for 3 months and that they're being treated, that's, you know, we all, you know, we use the, you know, the broken leg analogy too. And so is that, you know, if I'm going and getting treated for this, is that I'm coming back and I'm hopefully, you know, not going to be in the same position that, you know, that I was before. So just knowing, you know, keeping right. that in mind, is that now I have a medical condition that is being treated, and that I'm in a, mm-hmm. in a mode of recovery. And then, you know, and the other thing too, is just, what is, you know, it's just looking at, you know, where does, we heard the birds.
yeah.
So the other thing is
it's part of what makes podcasting with you fun, Phil. Yeah. There's just a menagerie always.
Indeed. But so that, you know, that's just one of the things that I think we want to keep in mind, is that, you know, this person is away and that they are being, you know, being treated, and, you know, mm-hmm. and that's really important. And so what is that going to yeah. look like, you know, when they come back? And so right. the question then as a leader, I think, is on an individual basis, like what is our return to work policy? Do we have a return to work policy for mental illness? Because a lot of us right. kind of do, and probably do to some degree, for, you know, like a back injury, you know, or, you know, what, right. whatever it is, you know, car, you know, whatever it is, we probably right. have some type of return to work. Well, do we have something in place for return to work after mental illness? Yeah.
And I would say that's something that we don't talk about. And so I think part of this from a Headspace perspective is recognizing that, you know, we are all human. And I think that's important to recognize in this scenario with this team member. The manager is a human being, the team member is a human being, and we have to create space to be human and have that experience, and recognizing that we don't know what someone else is going through, right? And we don't know what we don't know. And so we're going to talk and get into the return to work policy when we dig into the action steps. And that's a great example of where a lot of times we don't know what we don't know. And this manager said this is a first for them, like they've never experienced this. And so it's interesting because you and I both picked up on the same thing when we read this email, which was, so there was some language that we both picked up on. We talked about the team member attempted suicide, and both you and I, from being in the recovery space, are particularly sensitive and recognize that language is powerful and language matters. And that's an example for me. A lot of times when I talk to other managers, we're human and we don't know what we don't know. And so we're using language that has been modeled for others, or, you know, put out there. And it's interesting because I was looking and just refreshing myself on the EEOC standards when it comes to return to work. And even their language from the federal government, I thought was really, really interesting, because it read something about making failed suicide attempts. And I was just like, really? We're using that kind of language that has a negative connotation when we say failed or when we say attempted? You know, you and I were talking about when we use the word attempted, we associate it often as humans with negative things like attempted murder or an attempted crime. And it has a negative connotation associated with it. And so, you know, I think recognizing that we're human, we're not going to get this right. And even professionals who know about bias, who know about stigma, who know about the negative power that language can have, still screw it up. Mm-hmm. And so I think recognizing that it's okay to not know what you don't know, and recognize that this is not going to be easy. And don't stop asking the questions.
Yeah.
Don't stop talking about it. Don't stop looking at it, you know, it, because it is hard and it will probably get harder before it gets easier, but you're asking the right questions. And so from a Headspace perspective, I thought that was really, really important. And I know you had some thoughts on the language as well.
Yeah. So the language, the other thing that I wanted to touch on was, you know, the fear. So is, you know, and there's been a lot more research in veterinarians and veterinary professionals around access to means. And so what, you know, one of the things that we do know is that there are tendencies of different genders, different professions, you know, of what, mm-hmm. what the method or choice of trying to take our own life might be. And what's interesting is so Dr. Tracy Witte from Auburn, and actually Andy just, you know, was a co-author on a paper with her from her lab out of Auburn. But mm-hmm. in 2019, I think it was September, JAVMA 2019, yep. you know, had published a paper. And what was interesting is when we look at the toxicology reports of the decedents, is that in veterinary technicians, there were no technicians. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but there weren't technicians listed that barbiturates were found, you know, in their system. Mm-hmm. However, and this is something, you know, of course, close to both of our hearts is, you know, being people in long-term recovery from alcohol and substance use disorder, is that half of the technicians, you know, were positive for opioids. And so whether that, you know, and we don't know, all we know is that was present. We don't know if it was an accidental right. overdose. We don't know if it was intentional, right? Or, you know, or potentially it was associated, you know, with that, because we do know that, you know, one of the higher risks as well is, you know, as alcohol and substance use disorder, you know, as a risk right. factor for suicide. So again, one of the things on my soapbox of one of the things that I hope we do talk about more, but just saying is that, and I think this is going to get into a little bit of our discussion on the return to work policy, but that may or may not, I mean, we always want to be cognizant of access to means, but it may not be that may not be the, you know, the biggest risk potentially for, you know, for that person. And that's where, you right. know, trying to be, you know, and again, we'll discuss this, is, you know, possibly being, you know, having the opportunity, not getting into the specifics of it, but consulting with that person's mental health professional about, you know, best practices, what would we be best, you know, for this particular person coming, yeah, the support plan coming back. Yeah.
I think just recognize, so from a headspace perspective, recognizing that it's going to be emotional. No one has the answers. No one has all the answers, right? And this is going to be something that we fumble our way through. I know that the first time that I handled this situation in my own management career, I felt like I had no clue what I was doing and fumbled through the whole thing. And I don't even know that it's gotten any easier, because it's always emotional, because they're human beings and we care about each other. And so, you know, recognizing that it's going to be hard. Keep asking the questions, recognizing that the language matters. And one of the things that we can do as managers is work on educating ourselves about the power of language here, and then in turn, potentially educating the team. Hopefully this sparks some desire to bring mental health to the forefront in terms of both taking care of our team and also talking about it with the team. And I think the last piece that ties to that, though, from a headspace perspective, for me, that's really important as a manager, is remembering that we have to be respectful of team members' privacy, and we have to ask the team to do the same. And that's yeah. really hard. You know, when you mentioned, especially when you're working in a hospital environment that is maybe a smaller team or a particularly close-knit team, everybody has a tendency to be all up in each other's lives.
Yeah.
And we have a tendency to know the details, sometimes way too many details. And that goes for who's dating who, all the way to the details of what happened potentially when someone, you know, attempted to end their life. So I think that it is important to talk to the team about the fact that this is going to be hard, and we need to respect this person's privacy and let them be the guide and let them create boundaries. And we need to be able to respect that. And that's really, I think, sometimes as a manager, the hardest thing, because we care about them and we see the team caring about them. And when you care about somebody, the first thing you want to do is ask questions, you know? Yeah. And I think that's a really important piece, though, to recognize that you have to spend some time working through that from a headspace perspective and planning how are you going to help support this person's privacy and how are you going to get the team to support their privacy as well.
Yeah. And I think that's the, you know, you really hit on it, is if our guiding principle, you know, is empathy and respect, you know, in this transit is that's our North Star, is generally speaking, we're probably going to be okay. Like, you know, it's just no, or, but is, are we respecting the privacy of the, you know, of the individual, and then just going in with that, with a, you know, a curious, but not judgmental, you know, headspace, like you mentioned, just, you know, when they come in, is like, is it, you know, is there the ability to have contact? Like what, and, you know, discussing parameters, like with, you know, what are the boundaries that, you know, each person, that person is okay with? Cause some people may be okay, you know, with having the team want, you know what's going on. And it's just, right. And it's right. Just clarity around what the comfortable boundaries are, you know, and then just continuing, you know, in that trend, you know, when they're coming back, is just letting them know, like, you're a valuable part of the team. Like, you know, we want you back, and that you're what, you know, our, what we want is your well-being is the number one priority. So like any decision that we make is made, you know, anything that we do is going to be collaborative, and that it's with that intention, you know, in mind.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of those things. We can't ever do everything 100% right. But in this case, I think, you know, again, if we're staying within the legal boundaries of, you know, certain things, but if that's our guiding light, you know, we're going to be okay. But would it be okay now? You think kind of listing what that might look like for a return to work.
Yeah. Policy. Yeah. So let's do this. Cause I think you and I both are like itching to get into some specifics about how do we think through this? Because the questions here really had to do with what do I do when this person comes back? Yeah. And so I think we've got some tools that we want to kind of talk through. So let's do this. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll dive into the action steps piece of it. And we'll probably keep talking about headspace as we go. Does that sound like a plan?
Indeed. The birds seem to agree as well.
All right, we'll be right back. Hey friends, you have heard Andy and I talk on the podcast about our Uncharted Leadership Essentials certificate. And because you have, you know that we designed it with every member of the team in mind, because we believe that everybody on the team should have basic professional, personal, business development skills in their toolbox to be able to help make a maximally effective, efficient, and excellent team. And so we are bringing you one more way to have access to our certificate. That's right. You can take it asynchronously. Our wonderful partners at NAVC are bringing it to you through Vetfolio. So if you want to take the certificate online, you can do that today. And if you are the kind of person who's like, I need my CE to be in person, or you have learners on your team who you think would do better going through it together in a group live, we've got you, because we are hitting the road. We are going to be live and in person in Atlanta, Georgia, May 5th and 6th. And we are going to jam pack 2 days full of the entire certificate program, but it's going to be live and in person. And we're going to do it Uncharted style, which means we're going to talk about your practices. And so if you have been thinking about, man, I would love to do the certificate, but I would love to do it in person, now's your chance. Head over to unchartedvet.com/on the road, ONTHEROAD. And you will find out all the information about this upcoming roadshow that is happening in Atlanta in May and future dates and locations. And now back to the podcast. And we're back. So let's get back into this. Let's talk about the action steps, because I know you and I are both excited to get into this. So let's talk about what happens when we're prepping for and then working through someone's return to work after. Really, like, I think we're gonna take the suicide piece out of this, I think, is the healthiest way to do it, because it really has to do with mental health.
Mental health, right. 100%.
But really, I mean, because yes, there are circumstances and there is special scenarios that have to do with the mental health piece of it. But I think one of the healthiest things that we can do as managers is start to take the emotional knee-jerk reaction that has to do with it being associated with mental health and start to think about it the same way we would any other, you know, use the broken leg analogy. Like, what would we do for an employee who has to go out on a leave? Does it really matter what the reason is? And so I think that's part of the healthy piece of it from a manager perspective is, yes, let's be sensitive to the fact that there are additional things that we can do and should do when it comes to supporting mental health in our team. Yeah. And I think it makes the stigma effect less for me anyways, when I started associating it with the idea of what would I do for anybody else, you know, in any other situation. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that, and this is definitely twofold. So one is, okay, we're in the crisis, but thank goodness is the vast, vast majority of veterinary hospitals right in this moment aren't having to create a return to work policy for, you know, for an individual. However, what do we have, you know, what have we done as an organization, you know, around education? What have we done as leaders to decrease stigma, you know, in the workplace? Like, what policies do we have in place? What's the awareness around the resources we have? And then as leaders, are we, you know, do we look ourselves or have somebody come in to say, do we potentially need other resources? Like, do we have everything we need? And so I think that first might be the place to start is because this facilitates, like, if we have a good organizational mental health policy, you know, overarching policy, it's going to make this reintegration much better because the team's going to understand, they're going to be open. There's going to be some education around this. There's more open conversation that's appropriate, you know, type thing around this. And then just, you know, and certainly more understanding and more support for the person, you know, when they come back.
And I agree with you 100%. And I would hazard a guess that a lot of our listeners are going, great, but I don't have any of that. that was me as a manager, right? Like when this first happened, there's the panic of what do you do in the moment? Because like you said, we're in the crisis. How do we deal with it? Because we literally actively have someone who's trying to come back to work, and how do we do it? And it felt to me very unrealistic in that moment of now I've got to go do all of this education and learn all of these things. That felt really, really overwhelming. And so I think recognizing that, you know, it's important to talk about your point. It's so, so valid of the best way to have to deal with this is to be prepared for it, right? And have some preparation and recognizing that for, I would argue, most of us, when we get in situations like this, we're not actually prepared and we're flying by the seat of our pants.
Yeah, well, so what I want to say too is, so not insinuating when this crisis happens, now we've got to go do all this stuff all at once. Like that's not saying for the majority of listeners that, you know, hear this now, the place to start is doing a mental health audit. And Marty agrees is that, you know, it's just saying like, you know, the most straightforward place to start is do we have an EAP and what's the level of awareness around that? And that's an initial place, you know, to start.
So EAP, Employee Assistance Program, for anyone who didn't recognize that alphabet soup. But yeah, I think that's a great place to start because that was also my starting place was like, let's look at what we have. What resources do we have for the team already? Do they have access to mental health services through our insurance if we offer insurance? Do they have access to an employee assistance program that offers mental health services? What are, if the answer to either or both of those is no or none. What are the community resources in our individual community when it comes to mental health support? Because there are often, especially for clinics that are employing younger team members, there are often community resources for young adults, teenagers through young adulthood that are accessible for, you know, sliding scale, low cost, no cost. So I think those are three easy things that as a manager we can do. Look at what do we offer, if we offer insurance, if we offer an employee assistant program, what are the resources, and then what are the community resources? And then to your point, Phil, it does no good if the team isn't aware of the access that they have and through those resources.
Right, right. You know, to get on that, part of the newest iteration of the Merck study, or if it was separate, but I think the number was around like 32% of veterinary hospitals had an EAP. And I'm genuinely curious about that, because all I have, and let me say this, they may have answered this, and all I have is this number, but that number just has to be higher than that. So I'm just curious so let me say this, is that oftentimes even managers, the clinic itself, the hospital itself has access to an EAP and they don't know. Like we ended up, our group, pretty sizable. I mean, we had a three practice group here outside of Tampa. And I ended up, you know, asking, it was, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago, I asked, you know, our practice manager, I'm like, do we have an EAP? She said, no. But we ended up looking into it. We had it as a benefit associated with our payroll company.
Yep.
And so, you know, it was like, there we have it. It's like, you know, we have access to, you know, to this program. And so where I'm going with this, with the 32%, is if we just look at, you know, I'm not going down this rabbit hole, but if we look at the number of corporate, you know, corporate veterinary practices,
right,
I am almost certain that every single one of those has an EAP. And so if we just look at that means that then every other like private, you know, privately owned veterinary practice doesn't have an EAP. It's, you know, so the number, thank goodness, it's probably an awareness gap versus, you know, actual, I'm hoping.
Yeah. And there's three places that you should look if you don't know for your practice. Like Phil said, one is your payroll company, because that's often lumped in with your package that you get through them. The second is through your medical insurance. There are medical insurance companies now that have outsourced that piece and bundled it together with an EAP. And the third is actually through your liability insurance for the practice and or for your veterinarians. There are now, I'm seeing more and more where they have put some EAP resources together with your liability insurance. So
just to put a shout out to the state VMAs doing the work, is that probably, I think when we look, it's probably about a quarter of state VMAs have a member assistance program. So that's also, you know, also available. And like, depending on what program they have, there's access through that. Plus a number of other, if we get into it, there is almost always a way to get free access or at least initial access to a mental health professional somehow in veterinary medicine. We'll put all the resources up there, but like VINS, you know, Vets for Vets and Veterinary Support Foundation, NAMBI, you know, there's the Veterinary Hope Foundation. Yep. There's so many organizations, you know, and then the FVMA right now, like I'm really excited we're putting together one with where we're going to have a veterinarian who's a therapist and then a veterinary social worker. So we're actually going to have those in addition to our, you know, access to our EAP. So
regular benefits.
But
I love
just
it.
That's meaning awesome. That it's probably available and out there somewhere. And so again, like Stephanie was saying, it's just before you know, we get into an issue, it's just knowing where, you know, where the resources are for that.
I love it. Okay. So there's one last piece from an HR perspective that I have to drop in here before we get into the, how do we create a return to to work plan? Because I'm super interested. You've had a lot of experience working with and looking at stuff from countries outside of the States who are far more advanced when it comes to supporting mental health at work. And so I'm super excited to dig into that. The thing that I think there's two pieces from an HR perspective that are really important. As a manager, you need to prepare yourself. And so you need to know what you need legally. And there are legal concerns here. And so I'll drop some resource information in the blog for the EEOC, EEOC, because sometimes I slur the all together. I'll drop it in the show notes because it's really important to know what your legal requirements are as an employer. And the second piece of it is it's really, really important. We already talked about checking our biases. The number one thing that's important, I think, as a manager is to consider what you actually know. And so it's really important. We tend to look at situations, especially when they involve an employee that we care about. We tend to look at it emotionally. And it's really important for you to look at the situation objectively and actively work against any bias or stigma that may come with the notion or idea about mental health disease, mental health disorders and conditions. The number one thing that I think for me that I had to work to overcome is recognizing that no two people are the same and no two conditions are the same. And so, you know, when you go through an experience with a team member and you think, okay, I've been through this and I know what this is like, it's really, really easy to put your, to project your experience and feelings and bias onto another person. And we don't do it intentionally, but I think it's really important to recognize that everybody's different and every situation is different. And just because you had a team member who handled coming back from, you know, a time off, a leave of absence for mental health in the past doesn't mean that the same rules, structure, experience will apply to the next person. And so thinking about that is, I think, really, really important. And the way that I have learned to do that as a manager is to rely on the medical documentation that I'm being provided. It really helps with fighting your own bias and stigma. You have the ability to get information that tells you how to act as an employer, what the rules are, what the restrictions are, what the supporting requirements are going to be. And if you lean into that, I think it really helps. It has certainly helped me look at the situation objectively. And so I think from that perspective, the other preparation piece that everybody needs to do is that if you do not have a solid job description for every single position in your hospital and you do not have risk factors of that job and including potential access to lethal medications for those who have that access, now is the time to do that. Because the way, as a manager, part of the way that you work with mental health professionals who are supporting your team member in a situation like this is to provide them a detailed job description with the risk factors so that they can help accurately assess the risk for this employee returning to work. And far too often, I find that our job descriptions don't actually explain to people outside veterinary medicine what we do in veterinary medicine. And that goes for physical problems at work. I can't tell you how many times I've, you know, have seen someone say, well, this employee came back and there's no restrictions, but I know that they can't do this. Well, what does the job description say? If the job description doesn't say that you have to be able to lift a 75-pound dog on your own, how is the doctor that's trying to support this team member going to know that that is potentially a risk factor for them unless that employee tells them? And that's you putting the burden on the employees. So from an employer perspective, this is where you have to do a little bit of homework and using the time for the leave of absence to dig into what are those requirements legally? What are you bound to do as an employer legally? Like, now is the time to do that. Sorry, I had to insert that.
No, I mean, it's 100% valid. And so, you know, I was sitting in you and you when you mentioned, you know, that you want to do this now, like put these job descriptions together of everything. And, you know, and instantly it's like, oh my God, like the anxiety of, oh my God, I have to do that today. Like I'm listening to this and I'm driving into work and I'm a manager. It's like, oh my God, I have to do this right now. And also know that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so, you know, the thing that I would say too is that in your manager groups, and I mean, certainly in, you know, pitch to the Uncharted group, but, you know, in different areas, there'll be a template, you know, where they're going
to
have.
Your payroll company might have a template for you to start with.
And so, you know, people are genuinely, you know, very open to sharing those resources. However, having the, you know, is that you do need to have that checklist. And interestingly enough, so, you know, coming out this summer, we'll have some guidelines too for psychosocial risks, you know, in veterinary workplaces and, you know, and factors for that. But, you know, kind of OSHA for our brains, if you will, you know, as things that we know that, you know, can increase our risk for psychological harm, you know, in the workplace as well.
Let's talk a little bit about that because we've been talking about this return to work plan.
Yeah.
And for someone who hasn't experienced that or hasn't seen it, it is, I remember the first time that I was exposed to it, I was like, oh, okay, this makes perfect sense. You have a team member who has had some sort of, whether it's illness or injury mental or physical, and they've been out of work. It makes total sense to me now that there are questions that we should ask and some planning that should be done regardless of the circumstances to help support that person when they come back to work.
Yep.
So let's start there because you've had a lot of experience. The resources, almost all of the ones that I used, came from outside the States because I'm going to be honest, there's not a lot. Yeah. to go off of. The EEOC has done a great job of putting together some resources, and there certainly are resources that others have adapted, but there are other countries that are already doing what you referenced, Phil, which is basically OSHA for the mental health side for employees. So let's start there.
And so what I would say too, so the other thing we want to say is that, like, let's split this into two areas. So when we know, like if we know that the person is going to be going away, you know, for leave, is that we've got that pre-leave talk as the manager, then that, I think that's where knowing that they're supported 100%, knowing that they're respectful, and then also setting those boundaries of what are the parameters? Like how can we, what are we comfortable, you know, you mentioned like people are human, and like they want to know is like, can the manager reach out? You know, can I reach out on you know, occasion, you know, to extend support? Like, can I, you know, is it okay if, you know, if team members send?
Do you want to hear from the team?
Like, is that, can we filter it through me? Do you want nothing? Like, is it okay if, you know, coworkers let you know that everything's going to be okay, you know, whatever that is, like, but setting those things too before, you know, if we know beforehand, or, you know, when it's safe, like, can we have that, and then have that for as the you know, again, empathy and respect as our guiding principle, and then on the return to work, you know, what are the boxes that we want to check off? And you said first thing, you know, you said was, what are the job duties? Like, what are the things that if we're going to do this that we need, and then also the documentation. I mean, you know, having something, you mentioned, you know, getting something from, you know, from the doctor or professional, like what, you know, what does that look like? And
and I think that's, I think that that was at the heart of it here for me. The question that we got in the mailbag was really around wanting to make the clinic a safe space for this employee when they return. And their immediate fear was that their job puts them, and this is, I would say, this is where we have to check our bias, but this manager is like, okay, here's a team member who has, maybe drugs were involved, but maybe they weren't. And I have found that our automatic gut response as human beings is to go to, even if drugs weren't involved, there's drugs and they have access to it, right? Because we know that that is a risk factor. The question here is that a risk factor for this specific employee? And if so, in what ways? And to your point at the very beginning of the episode, I think the really important thing is that we have to recognize we are not mental health professionals.
Yeah.
And even if we are, Even if you have a manager who happens to be a, you know, social worker or a you know, a therapist, you're not that employee's mental health professional. And so we need to step back and think about what are the risk factors valid that this manager is concerned about access to drugs. And that concern should be no more than any other concern on that list. And so the best thing we can do to support this employee is to recognize, okay, they have access to control, they have access to drugs. What kind of drugs? They have access to the control drug box, and everybody's mind goes to euthanasia solution. And as you mentioned, Phil, we know from the studies that are out there, that might not be the big concern for technicians. They have access to opiates. Okay, that's a valid concern because we know what the data shows there with technicians. And
for anybody, like not, and also just want to say, like not singling out technicians just as,
right. Yeah.
Just so
but in this case, we're talking about a technician, right? So, like looking at it from that perspective and looking at, are there access to other potential lethal drugs? How many clinics keep insulin in the fridge? You know, and so looking at what are the actual risk factors for this team member, those ones, and the physical ones. Are they being asked to work 12-hour shifts? You know, what are their breaks like? How does, when are they getting food? When are they, you know, calories are important. All of those things are part of it. And it's not your job to figure out what to do with that information. Yeah. And so part of the return to work policy is we do this together with the employee, right? This is not us projecting our boundaries and barriers to try and keep ourselves safe as a practice and cover our own ass on someone else, which is how a lot of us are taught to do it. Yeah. Here's this form, you go deal with it, right? That's not the way that I would want to approach it here. We want to sit down and work with the employee and talk about those things.
Yeah. And one of the things you just mentioned, and again, if we look at risk factors, you know, if we look at these risk factors in the workplace that increase our likelihood for burnout, for mental illness, psychological harm one of the things that's interesting, you know, is that we're looking at that this person is alone, but then we're saying, okay, they're alone with the drug, but it's like this person is also potentially, you know, alone. Like the doctor is going to bed, but where is the, right. Does this person then like, what if I have a thought? Like, what if I have, where I am now isolated. And so isolated work is actually a risk factor for us. So what are, not so much, you know, not even the drug, but then like, Is there something in place? Like have we taken into account, does this person have, you know, is there a support network at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning? Like, you know, is there something, and this isn't just for this person, but any isolated work, is that if I am by myself, like at work, if I'm isolated, like that is a risk factor. And like, what are the things that we're doing to potentially, you know, to potentially mitigate that. So that's one of those other things that, again, it's looking at the nature of work, looking at the work design for this particular, you know, particular place person. This particular person, but also for this environment itself is that the risk factors aren't, you know, are for everybody, but, you know, we're concerned about this person. But this is where I was going a little bit where, we want to do things that are specific, you know, to help this individual. Are there things just in the workplace in general that we can elevate that are gonna that are gonna both help that person and then help all the employees?
And I think making sure that you're doing this with the employee, and there's questions. Phil and I are gonna drop some lists of questions because we could sit here and talk about this for 3 hours, and I'm not sure everybody would keep listening. And I want to make sure that there are some good resources here, because this is something that both you and I are particularly passionate about, Phil. But I think one of the number one questions that I think is really important for us to talk about before we go is asking, are we okay as your employer? are we okay to speak to your health professionals mm-hmm. about your recovery and your work capacity if they contact us is one. And if the employee gives permission for you to reach out to the health professionals, that's where it gets a little dicey, right? And so the way that I like to ask the team member is, hey, if your support team reaches out to us, I'm going to give you this information. Do I have your permission to talk to them? Because part of it is that's part of working together, right? I'm not a mental health professional, and I want to take care of you here in the practice. And so can we create a team? Can we work together to help create a supportive environment? Getting that permission is so, so important.
Yeah. And just, you know, looking at other, you know, we mentioned other countries, this is part of the return to work program, is that there is consultation, you know, with the workplace, with that person's provider, you know, mental health provider, right, to make sure that we are able to do the appropriate accommodations or as far as just like the pace of reintegration, like, is this, you know, here, right, again, duties, this is the level, these are, you know, potential stressors. Is this appropriate? And like asking the mental health professional, and the mental health professional then just guides based on, you know, on that. And I just, that to me is, it's like, I understand it from, I guess, from a legal point of view, but it's challenging that we can't, that isn't more normalized like it, you know, like in Canada mm-hmm. or, you know, in some other countries yeah. where that's part of the return to work policy, like to make the best.
Well, and I think the
plan for the, for
I think
everybody.
The way we normalize that yeah. is to start to ask those questions the way that we can. Right. So there's that doctors are bound by HIPAA laws here, and there is confidentiality, and you can absolutely, as a patient, give permission for that kind of thing. And most people don't know that. And so making sure that you're as a manager, that you're asking that question of your team and encouraging that person, that employee that you want to help support them. And so the best way to do that is for them to help facilitate that conversation with their health providers, I think is really, really important. And I think, so wrapping it up, I feel like it's interesting because I feel like we didn't talk so much about the access to drugs, which was at the heart of this ask. And I do think that we did, in the sense that as managers, as practice owners, often the first place that our mind goes is to the drug box, mm-hmm. whether it's someone who has, you know, in this case, attempted suicide, whether it is a team member who has a substance use disorder and has gone to treatment and is coming back to the practice, coming back to work, our minds automatically go to the drug box. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't, because that is a risk factor. It is always a risk factor. There are lethal, you know, it's access to lethal means. And I think we have mm-hmm. to think about that. And I know that you and I are both really passionate about this from the stigma perspective. Mm-hmm. It's time that we start stepping back as employers and recognizing that the drugs are not the only risk factor, nor are they, I would say, often the biggest risk factor for a lot of people. Because as you mentioned at the very beginning, it's multifactorial. Mm-hmm. And when you combine working isolated, when you combine the physical stresses of working nights, overnight shifts, mm-hmm. there's tons of published research on how much of a negative impact that has on our physical and mental yeah. well-being. When you combine being alone, working overnights, yes, the access to the drug box, but there are all of these other risk factors for team members that are as significant and could be more significant than access to the drug box. And so I think it's, you and I agree, right, that it's time to start asking better questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, for me, the best thing we can do with this podcast is just recognizing that there is stigma.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stigma. And the only way we start to overcome that is by having the conversation.
Absolutely.
I feel like I could sit here, friend. I know we could sit here and, yeah, and talk for hours and hours. Thank you so much for doing this. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, my friend.
I feel like there's a lot more soapboxing that you could do. Maybe we need a second part of this, yeah, episode, maybe.
Yeah. But I think that too, I just, you know, before we wrap up, is that there, you know, other countries, when we talk about the, you know, workplace suicide risk, is that those are the main things that are looked at, you know, is social support, you know, in the workplace, job design, you know, organizational justice, like, you know, are things fair? Is there job overload? You know, is there poor change management? You know, am I allowed to, you know, can I do my job in the way that I think is best, you know, best for me? Am I micromanaged? Though all of those things are hugely impactful, you know, when we talk about that. And so that's what I think is that is a box to, you know, for us to make sure that we're, you know, we've done everything we can to, you know, limit access. And what I would say is that goes for, you know, for everybody, not just that person. And that would be something too, is not to single, you know, not to then single that person out, but just look at, you know, the policy. Yeah, the policy in general. But that these other, yeah, factors in the workplace, you know, are critical to our mental health and, you know, workplace suicide prevention.
Thank you, friend, yeah, for being here. This was good. I hope that this conversation was helpful. We're gonna drop some resources into the show notes, including a list of questions to, yeah, ask when you're trying to create a return to work policy, and some information from the EEOC and JAVMA on what we've talked about today. So if you're not in the habit of checking that out, today is an episode that I would definitely suggest doing just that. And you can find it at the blog over at unchartedvet.com. So thank you so much, Dr. Yay. Phil Richmond, for being back with me and talking this through. And I look forward to talking with you on the podcast again.
You soon. Too. Thank you, Stephanie Goss.
Take care, friends.
Bye-bye.
And that's a wrap on another episode of the Uncharted Podcast. Thanks for joining us and spending your week with us. If you enjoyed this week's episode, head over to wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. It's the best way to let us know that you love listening. We'll see you next time.